Hi, this is Jury Duty. I'm your host, Chris Terracone. As we mentioned at the beginning of Monday's podcast, we have paused our coverage of the trial of Alex Murdaugh for the next 7 weeks. This week, in recognition of the death of O.J. Simpson last Wednesday, April 10th, we are reaching into the archives of Crime Story Media to present a series of special interviews related to the way that the historical narrative of Simpson's trial for the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman have been preserved for posterity. Yesterday, we presented part one of Carrie's two-part interview with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander, the creators of the Emmy and Golden Globe-winning limited series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Today, we present part two of that interview. One further programming reminder, in parallel with the premiere of The Jinx 2 on the Max streaming service, we are scheduling a special event for Season 10 of the Jury Duty podcast. For each of the 6 weeks of The Jinx 2 series, we will re-release four of our favorite episodes about the Durst trial from the Jury Duty feed for a total of 24 episodes. The first episode of Jury Duty, The Durst Trial's Greatest Hits, will drop on April 22nd. Now, on to part two of Carrie's two-part interview with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander, which was conducted in the spring of 2018 at USC's School of Cinematic Arts in Los Angeles.
Today's podcast is a conversation with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander. During part two of the conversation, we take a deep dive into the issues that arose during the writing and production processes of The People vs. O.J. Simpson. And then Scott and Larry field questions from students in the class. In this class, we've discussed kind of briefly the legacy of shows like Dragnet and Hill Street Blues as iconic presentations of the police as kind of protectors of the social order, and, you know, with Hill Street Blues kind of humanizing them through soap opera, but still status quo. You look at the LAPD in a completely different way.
And we didn't talk about Dragnet, but we talked about Jack Webb a lot. This is sort of like my own little obsession. The LAPD got so attacked during the trial, and to quote, you know, Jeff Toobin, Johnny would just keep throwing shit at the wall, and whatever stuck is good enough. And Johnny would throw a lot of conflicting theories. But as long as one theory stuck for one juror and a different theory stuck for another juror, Johnny's golden. And so we kept saying, the night of, we are treating them like Jack Webb characters. They are just by the book, yes ma'am, no ma'am, procedural, doing their jobs. They've got gloves, they got little bags. There is nothing fishy going on. And this was very influenced by Toobin. Toobin is so dismissive of any conspiracy theory as just being so dumb. And in episode 7, Marsha actually talks through the impossibility of the conspiracy theory, just in terms of how you would have had so many policemen in on this scheme within minutes of learning about the murders. It's so crazy. So we wanted to present, especially with Mark Furman. Oh my God, you got to see Furman in 1 and 9. Furman in 1 is just—he's just a cop doing a job, and there's nothing fishy about it. And when they end up moving from Nicole's condo to OJ's house, there's nothing scurry about it. It's so interesting because it's before Google. You know, they can't be looking stuff up. They don't have anything. There's no computerized database. He'd been to OJ's house because OJ had beat up Nicole once, and Furman was the cop who got called. And so he knew the address. And so it's just very logical. And then when they find the glove, we didn't want anything misterioso going on. We didn't want like, ooh, what did Furman just do? Oh, why did he disappear behind the bushes for a second? We didn't want anything. We just want like,
But we did not show the moment of him finding the glove.
Oh, correct. Well, No, we were covering our asses. We wanted to cut away and then cut back just so we could have it both ways. We want the audience to go through sort of like what America went through and what the jurors went through, which was you go in assuming like, well, the cops are just doing their job. And then midway through the series, you're going, wait, was there something fishy going on? I mean, I personally don't think the cops did anything fishy. And OJ did it. It was just sort of an interesting experiment just to play that first night just totally straight up.
The sense was to take that opening night and do it as a procedural and make you think that everything they're doing is correct. But as almost everything that you see the cops do in episode 1 comes back to haunt them later on. Or, you know, it's everything we're just doing. This seems like every acts of even like, you know, Van Adder getting blood at the scene and stuff like that comes up in later episodes as being like, wait a second, why did that go down? Everything could be interpreted in a different way.
Tell us about crafting the various perspectives on Furman, particularly Marcia Clark, Chris Darden, and Shapiro and Cochran. Like those, the parallel duels between them is kind of a fascinating Rorschach test about the LAPD and the cultural belief in the essential goodness of cops in the white world and the alternative perspective in the black world.
We set up very early in the series that Chris was distrustful of Furman. When Marcia is assigning jobs to each member of the team, and it's sort of like a whole table of white people, and she's saying, all right, okay, you'll go interview that witness, you'll go find this piece of evidence, and then she gets to Darden, and she says, and you can have Furman. And Chris just looks at her, and he sort of feels like the one black guy is being asked to handle the questionable racist cop. We tried to have kind of a rhyming argument between the Chris and Marcia through the latter episodes, which was Marcia saying, "Don't have him put on the glove," and Chris saying, "Don't put Furman on the stand," and each of them refusing to listen to the other one.
Right.
Which is sort of like worked emotionally as the problem with their relationship, that it's like they were the two survivors of the Titanic who like went through this whole experience together, but they still, in terms of crossing lines and learning to trust each other, each of them refused to listen to the other one on the key issues.
And then Shapiro and Cochran, and you know, Shapiro being the instigator of using the race card strategy, but then kind of becoming afraid of it.
Yes.
Right. I think you answered the question right there. That's sort of what happened. I mean, Shapiro invented the race defense. I mean, he's one who discovered the sort of truth about Furman. Shapiro was sort of waving the race card in order to try to cut a deal with Garcetti. It was sort of like, you know, he felt by threatening, you know, the city with riots and things like that, that they would be able to cut a deal and OJ would be able to, like, you know, plead to a lesser charge or something. And he was even using Johnny as that. I mean, he was like, he was trying to get Johnny Cochran on the defense team to scare Garcetti. But what happens is when Johnny actually gets on board, he kind of kicks Shapiro to the curb, and Shapiro is now a man without a country. Tries to backpedal, but he can't really backpedal on the defense strategy.
Well, we can't, like we said earlier, we wanted the audience to almost end up liking everybody in terms of liking or understanding Marcia, Johnny, Chris, Ito, Shapiro, Kardashian. We wanted you to sort of kind of be rooting for everyone. And Shapiro, who can be such a ridiculous person at times. I mean, when we talked with John about, you know, how he was playing the part, he said, I'm playing him like an agent. You know, like all those studio executives you meet. Which is like, oh, sure, that's great. So even Shapiro, of all people, had this arc, you know, like Larry's saying, where he went in just wanting to cut a deal because that's what he does. He doesn't go to trial. That's not his game. And then he comes to regret it. And then he got the scenes with Linnell, his wife, saying, my friends don't even want to have dinner with us anymore because of what you're doing, and you're gonna burn down the city. And he actually had a scene we shot for episode 9 and it got cut out. It was hard to get it on the schedule, and then we ran out of money, and then we shot it, but it was shot with like a really, it didn't have enough extras. It was like too pared down. But it was a true story, which was near the end of the trial, Shapiro goes to Rosh Hashanah services, which is a holy Jewish holiday, and he walks into the temple and he gets booed, which is crazy. And we thought, wow. I don't know why. For some reason, we had Italian Travolta playing a Jew, and we had Jewish swimmer playing an Armenian. I'm not sure how that happened. But anyway, John with the Torah in the temple got cut out.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And now, back to Cary Antholis' interview with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander.
I noticed something in watching it tonight in terms of Shapiro. In the moment where Johnny pauses his questioning of Furman and goes to confer with the rest of the Dream Team, whose idea do you think it was to ask the last question that he asked, which is, did you plant any evidence that night? Because the way I watched it tonight was, it was Shapiro's idea.
I don't know if it was written that way, but I do seem to remember the being shot that way.
I'm having trouble. I should have gotten here an hour earlier and watched it with you guys, because I love episode 9. My memory of it is that Johnny is just doing theater, and that he's just taking a big hammy dramatic pause before he comes in with the closing.
Mm. Interesting.
But you're right. John is doing that.
Right.
I can't remember.
And that just might be Travolta.
A lot of times actors do that, where they
want to be proactive, and so they're doing that. I mean, I think one of the reasons
or there's a version that it was all scripted between the team.
Right.
We're gonna pretend to have one last
question.
It's like in Bull Durham, where the catcher goes out to talk to the pitcher, and then they say, "Where do you want to go for dinner tonight?
Right.
Do you feel like steak or fish?
Right.
Okay. And then they go.
We like episode 9 because it opens with a screenwriting teacher, you know. It has our favorite line, where that whole section where they, how can you teach screenwriting if you haven't sold a script?
And then everybody reacts like, oh, come on, man. Like, that's
that's our favorite joke in the whole miniseries. A couple months ago, I went to the Austin Film Festival. Bunch of kids from the North Carolina School of the Arts came to the festival. And two of them came up to me and said, our teacher is Laura Hart McKinney. I was like, oh my God, what happened? I was like, oh, Laura was very quiet that next day.
Well, no, I mean, I talked to someone who went a step further than that. And maybe everyone watched the episode, and I don't even think Laura knew she was going to.
No, she didn't know she was going to be in episode 9.
But they came into the class, and Laura's just sitting there like this in front of the class, really quiet. And they're like, you know, it's like a couple minutes, you know, the class should have started by now. And then she just looks up and says, "Yes, I watched it. I saw it." Supposed to be a great teacher, by the way. I mean, when you talk to the students, they do think she's great.
Share with us any other kind of anecdotal react, because the miniseries became a phenomenon, won every award, and was watched by everyone.
It's our first TV show, and so we'd never experienced any of this stuff, and the recaps the next day, we loved. We were so happy the show was not streaming. We were so happy that we were old school. Tuesday night, 10 o'clock, you want to watch OJ, you got to be home, which was really fun, because we kept hearing from friends saying, oh, you're ruining my Tuesdays, I can't go out anymore, and that was great. It was like old school. It's the water cooler talk. Every Wednesday, it's what people talk about. And we would just come into the office, and we would spend 5 hours
going through Twitter. And
it was the recaps, which were, some of them were really snarky and funny, and some of them would do like little screen grabs with little thought bubbles above Marsha's head and, oh, my hair, you know, like weird jokes. But then a lot of them were really thoughtful, and it felt like these people were staying up all night Tuesday writing these grandiose essays about our show, and it was like they were writing term papers, and they were making connections between episodes, and they were making connections that we hadn't even thought of.
Right?
They were, it was like so cool that the people were taking the ambition of the show so seriously.
That was really nice. Was that people engaged with the show and took what we were trying to do very, very seriously. I mean, we're used to movies, which are sort of like they have that opening weekend, or even when we're sort of doing Oscar things, where it's become that month. But this was, every single week there was a full meal, and the show works really well if you stream it from, you know, you watch all the episodes back to back to back to back. But we felt like just like one at a time, let people discuss it for a week, and let people, you know, and so and it was also very important. So the show really had endings that made you just like, you know, like want to come back and watch more. And one of the things that we had never done, because we'd only done movies, was even the commercial breaks. That we initially thought that was going to be a thing we'd hate, the idea that you have to like just interrupt the show. We found it was like a new writing tool that we didn't, you know, that if you had whatever the line was before the commercial break, all of a sudden had so much more emphasis. It also didn't seem to land. So for us, it was like It wasn't like an old fashioned serial where it was, you know, we were ending scenes, but it gave this different feeling to and so we loved it. We actually loved doing that stuff.
Because we had never done TV and we didn't really understand what you're supposed to do every week, we came up with this idea, which was each week is almost like a different movie. Each week has its own idea. And it's like, you know, episode 2 is the Bronco. Episode 6 is Marcia has gender problems. Episode 8 is the jury. Episode 9 is the Furman trial. Actually, we call it the John Grisham night. Right. It's our crazy courtroom theatrics thing with like a lot of plot twists. And again, going back to the recap people were just so delighted by this because they didn't know what they were going to get each week. And so then they would like, oh, well, this is more of a tragedy week. This is more of a comedy week. This is more of a thriller week.
Right. The episode 9, because you just watched it, we would joke that it's the only time that the OJ trial behaved like a television show. Twists and turns on the witness stand and surprise witnesses and all that kind of crap. But you know, usually that stuff's kind of bogus. And this was then, and we felt like particularly it's one of the times we were close to Tubin in the sense that that's the chapter where you just can't stop reading because it's a page turner and every beat is something else is happening. And so we really treated that as just like this is our legal thriller episode.
9 has a lot of fun jokes. I'm just giggling remembering Nathan in the courtroom in North Carolina. When he's just doing all that molasses syrup kind of stupidity, and it's done really well. And Anthony did a great job where he like did it all in one shot, and it's Nathan's hilarious in that scene.
You were talking about bloggers, and there's one person in particular I put up in the Dropbox that two articles relevant to these two episodes. But what I'll do after this class is put up the entirety of Dennis Bingham's kind of
the professor.
Yeah, no, this is
we call him the professor.
He was a professor from Indiana. I'm from Indiana, and I did not know this person whatsoever. But he wrote a textbook on biopics and gave Scott and I a lot of real estate in that book, even though we'd never met him or even talked to him. But he really saw us as kind of a turning point in the how biopics were done, and he just started this blog where he would talk about our things. And you know, like, it was not a blog. I mean, it really was a scholarly essay. And we would just sit there, literally.
It's like, refresh.
When is it coming up? When is it going up?
And sometimes it's like 1 o'clock. It's like time for lunch. And like, the professor hasn't uploaded yet. I was like, should we wait? Yeah.
Sometimes it even took an extra day because there's so much he would do. But it was like, we just couldn't wait until the professor told us what our show is about.
We're going to turn it over to student questions, which I'll read to you. This is the first one. Did you write with two audiences in mind, those who lived through the OJ trial and a younger generation who did not?
That was on our mind all the time, that we were literally writing it for two audiences. That there are people who know every detail of the OJ trial. They know every single, you know, the car washing guy, they know every single thing. And they were, you know, we also knew it was so high profile, you couldn't get anything wrong. Second, you made any fuck up of any kind, you were going to be the Twitter would tear you apart. But
Larry lives in fear of Twitter.
Oh, everyone lives in fear of Twitter these days.
I'm not on Twitter, so I'm not scared of it.
And then we had this other audience, which is basically probably most of you guys.
Well, we've got kids who are college age.
Right.
So it was almost like market testing. You know, I could go home to dinner and say, you know, have you ever heard of Bob Shapiro? Who's that? Okay, we're going to have to explain this. And particularly OJ. Our kids grew up in a universe where OJ is this chunky guy with a sullen face eating oatmeal cookies in prison in Nevada. And the OJ Larry and I grew up with was this heroic, cheerful, all-American, everybody loves OJ, and always with a big smile on his face. And that was the OJ that everyone couldn't wrap their heads around had committed two murders.
Right.
Particularly for young people, we had to impart this idea to the audience.
So strange enough, you just watched the first episode. Also, one of the last things we wrote in that episode was OJ's introduction. When our first draft kind of met OJ in that Chicago bedroom when he gets the phone call, and we decided it was kind of important to give OJ a scene before he's a murder suspect. Technically, he's actually already committed the murder, but he's not a murder suspect yet. And so that scene in the back of the limo where OJ talks about being a celebrity and about how he felt about Willie Mays. And we felt you needed at the beginning to get some of that OJ charm before you know what went down.
I mean, and we are also always trying to oversell the period and how life was different 20 years ago. And then we had a lot of fights about cell phones, and I think there's a whole school of screenwriting theology now that sort of thinks cell phones have ruined movies because characters just keep calling each other up, and it's always like scenes intercutting two people on cell phones. And so we had these fights about, like, cell phones were actually pretty rare in 94, and who's allowed to have a cell phone, because if you start giving it to too many characters, it's a cheat. Middle class characters would not have had cell phones in 94. I think we didn't want Shapiro to have one on him during the Bronco chase, because there's a big crazy joke where everyone in the world knows that OJ is being chased on the freeway except for his lawyer. Right. He's the only person who doesn't know, and it's because we have him in his car listening to Al Jarreau, seeing What's Love Got to Do with It. Oh, no. We're in this love together. Sorry. We're in this love together. And so in that case, Shapiro could not have a cell phone.
It was true, by the way.
Yeah.
Not the Al Jarreau part, but he was oblivious to it.
Yeah.
But like things like Kardashian, we had to make sure people understood that Robert Kardashian was not a famous person. We were looking at the first news conference where Kardashian reads OJ's suicide note, and the press literally doesn't know who he is. And they keep on asking, can you spell your last name? Can you spell your last name? And he literally has to spell his name to the net. And this is 95 million people are watching this Bronco chase. He has to spell his name to tell them who he is. And while we were writing the scene and watching, we're like, wait a second, this is like, were the kids watching this? And so we're like, of course, their dad's on TV and the biggest day of television of all time. Of course they're watching this. So then we cut to the Kardashian girls watching this. And they're like, you know, and they're seeing their dad spell their last name on television. And we just had them like, hey, they're saying Kardashian on TV. And then that one moment, it was like creating this Frankenstein monster that of course they became who they are. I'm not knocking the Kardashians, but they came.
Hey, no one said a word, Larry.
I know. But for us, it was like,
continue, please.
It, the light bulb went off. An anecdote. I mean, the only person I bum rushed in the entire thing was I was at dinner somewhere on the West Side, and I was sitting there, and Kanye and Kim came in, and I'd never met either one of those, and I'm like, I got to get over there and say something to somebody. And so they ate quicker than I did, and so they were walking out to their car, and I was like, because I knew Kim liked the show. Kim was, and so I went, hi, you know, I'm my writing partner and I, we created People versus OJ. And she was like, oh, thank you so much. Oh, you've taught me so much about my father. And it was like, it was this beautiful moment. And the next day I went online, and there was this great photo bomb of me behind Kanye walking out to the car. So my proudest moment.
We really had no contact with anybody who's a character in the show. Although for some reason, Kardashian's girlfriend from 94 dragged us down and took us to lunch, and she wanted us to put her into the show because she was in that, we knew she was. She was in the house when they were hiding him from the cops and from the DA.
Right.
And we're thinking, why do you want to be in that scene? Everybody in that house was kind of, was breaking the law. They were hiding a fugitive.
Yeah, you saw that scene. That's one of the scenes we're most proud of. Is that sort of craziness that's happening at Kardashian's house, where
it's the Marx Brothers
doctors
scene.
Are there, and people keep coming over and keep coming over, and they keep delaying the
ding dong, ding dong.
Yeah.
The studio lawyers said, you can't see Kim. It's like, why not? It's like, I don't know. She's trademarked her name or something, or she'll sue us. It's like, she's a public figure. If there's one person on our planet who's a public figure, it's her. It's like, you can't do it. And we basically put our feet down, like, we're saying you can't kill yourself in Kimmy's bedroom. It's like, it's the best line in the whole show. And then Ryan took our side, thank God. It's like Ryan would occasionally throw his weight around in really weird ways. It's like, oh, it's so important that the Kardashians hit that line. And so we had to kind of deal with the lawyers that we never used her name ever again.
Yeah.
So in any other scene with the girls, it's like, it's Chloe, or I don't even know the other names. Who's the other one? Courtney, thank you. You hear Chloe. It was us doing like legal horse trading so we could say Kimmy's bedroom.
But of course, that is one thing they argue about, whether it was actually in Kim's room or was Courtney's room. I think that, you know.
Oh, it's Kimmy's room. And then of course, they put that line in all the commercials because it's a good line.
Here's the second question. Clearly, you do massive research for your work. How do you balance research and theme and character when crafting your scripts?
I mean, research, we love research too. So we love finding out the true things, and it's kind of second nature now. I think we both know what makes the other person laugh, and we look for the idiosyncratic details. So a lot of times during reading all these court transcripts, it can be really, really dry. But when something stands out as being a little wacky or a little weird, we'll underline it and circle it and try to emphasize the unusual aspects of it. The relationship with theme and research is, hopefully, you kind of, it sounds kind of intuitive, but a lot of times we know what we want to say before we do the research. We know enough about, we've said yes to this project because we know enough about the project that we know there's something, we have something we want to say about that project. So when you're doing the research with, or you're not trying to, you know, find an idea, you're trying to like work at, you know, like how can I find the ways of supporting what I want
to
say?
Sometimes we take all the research and we try to organize it.
Yeah.
You know, in the case of this show, it would be Marsha quips, you know, OJ talking about race. I mean, in the old days, you know, we always do lots of highlighting. Tubin wrote the book so long ago that we were not able to get a searchable version of it, which was really a problem, you know, because you go, what's that thing Shapiro said to his wife? And we couldn't look it up. This is the first project we've ever done where we became really reliant upon our assistant, Tim. Because at a certain point, we had 40 or 50 OJ books in our office, and they've all got highlighting in them. And then we had also had Fox hire a second researcher for us for specific themes that we thought were going to be interesting. So the research, we had the researchers research how did mainstream media cover each event in the trial versus how did black newspapers cover it, which we thought was kind of interesting. And then we had, you know, a big binder of that. I'm trying to remember some of the other, like, sort of thematic kind of ideas we had the researchers do. And so we ended up having basically two bookshelves of information. At a certain point, our brains melted down. Our brains did not have access to the information anymore. We just, it was so much stuff. And it was 3 years that we did this. And we'd get to a point where we would finally just have to scream, Tim, What did Darden's dad say to him after the second Oakland trip? Oh, his dad said, it's like somewhere in the back of my head, I remember there was something interesting his father said about race, but I can't remember the line and I can't even remember where I read it anymore.
That's always a problem. I mean, if it's just a matter of looking something up, you can tend to, after 15 minutes or so, find it. But when you don't remember where it came from and there's 30 books staring at you, that's the problem.
Yeah, and then, you know, and then we got all the Time Magazine articles, and then LA Times articles, and the New York Times, and Newsweek, and there was just so much. We will happily over research. I mean, traditionally, we've always said with our biopics, we spend 6 months in research and then 6 months on the first draft on features, and we always warn the producers it's going to be 1 year before you get a draft, because a lot of it is journalism, a lot of it is about weird people that haven't been covered a lot, and we're tracking people down, and we're doing OJ, we didn't do any interviews because you didn't need to, because there's 1,000 books, but you know, with you know, Man on the Moon or Larry Flint or Big Eyes, you know, we're doing the interviews ourselves.
The next question is, what advice would you give a young screenwriter without resources who wants to write a biopic? How do you deal with life rights or book rights if you don't have resources?
We tend to not get rights, or at least not let that cripple us. I mean, our biopics tend to be about famous people, and they often are about famous dead people. And famous dead people really don't have rights. As we always joke that the third act of the Larry Flint movie is about what you can say about a public figure. We're never out to libel anybody or say anything bad about anybody, but for the most part, you can kind of, you know, if the person put themselves in the public eye, you can sort of make a movie about them. It also depends on the balls of the studio you're working for, though, too, whether they're willing to stand up. Sometimes they're chicken.
But it's not necessarily about needing money to go write the script. I mean, I mean, people are as Larry Flynt. We had the rights to nothing. And at that point, we were scared of Larry Flynt, and we didn't want him to find out what we were doing. I mean, after the movie, we became friends with him. But initially, we were going behind his back, and we were just sort of putting out the word to ex-employees of Larry Flynt Publishing or people who had worked in his house or former limo drivers or former cooks. We were just trying to get juicy stories. And that kind of stuff, word got out, and we would get someone's phone number. We'd call them up, and they'd say, "You going to pay me?" We go, "No, we'll buy you lunch." And for most people, that's fine. It just means they get to tell a couple hours of war stories, and we have a tape recorder running.
I think the only thing that we started on our own that we didn't have rights, we actually pursued rights, was Big Eyes, because we knew that in order to make the movie, you would need Margaret Keane's art. So we thought it was important to get her permission before we even started.
If you're writing about a deceased person, unless there's some kind of music rights involved or it's another painter, you don't really need rights. It's like Larry and I wish we were still in high school, you know, writing our senior paper, because we love to go. I don't know why, we're really loyal to the UCLA Research Library for some reason. We love to go down into where all the old newspapers and magazines are, and go on the periodicals index, and then find all the magazine articles from the 60s and the 50s, and none of this stuff is uploaded, and you can't Google this stuff, and it's not online, and you get the old microfiche, and whoever the person is you're interested in, you look them up in the pink periodicals book, and then you get at the microfiche, and you find the old article from, you know, New York Times from 1947, and it's all available, and it's all free. You don't even need a library card.
Here's the next question. How did the transformation from casual observer to heavily invested expert impact your opinion of the OJ case, the characters, and the verdict?
Well, I don't think we were casual. I mean, we were non-pros about it, but
I was casual. I didn't follow it that much.
I mean, but it was hard not to when you were living through it. I mean, even like, and when we were going through this, when we were making The People versus Larry Flynt, and our director, Milo Schwarman, was obsessed with it, and he'd follow it nonstop, and we were even people were being cast in the film based on their appearances in on court TV.
That's true.
Like there was a pundit who winds up playing Jerry Falwell's lawyer in the movie, who was just a legal pundit that was on court TV covering the OJ trial. You knew enough about it that you got excited when he said, "We're doing OJ as a miniseries." And you're like, "Yes." You knew. I mean, so
but I never watched it. I would read it in the LA Times the next day. Yeah. I wasn't watching court TV. I mean, certainly say I like Johnny a lot more now than I did back in 95. Yeah, I sort of admire him a lot more now. What's funny is I actually grew up in Brentwood, and we decided to sort of make Brentwood this kind of running joke in the show, and I had never really thought of Brentwood as really much of anything. It's just like this, I don't know, it's just a neighborhood in town. In terms of storytelling, differentiating between different pockets of Los Angeles, and there's downtown, and there's Brentwood, and there's Simi Valley, and there's the Valley, and it's got all sort of, again, in trying to do the tapestry of the show. Well, Bob Shapiro lives in Brentwood, and OJ lives in Brentwood, and Marsha, she's in the Valley because she can't afford to live over the hill, and this all sort of figures into just the socioeconomic story that's being told.
I think one of our favorite books on the OJ trial, if you want more info, was written by Dominic Dunn, who was actually a character in our show. Robert Morris played him. He wrote kind of, it's not really a fictional version, but it's called Another City, Not My Own. He writes about himself, but he fictionalizes himself. But it's the story of the OJ trial told through like lunches with famous actors and things like, because Dominic came into town to cover the trial, and so it's basically, it was all about him. Like, I had lunch with Elizabeth Taylor today, and she asked me about this thing, and I told her about this, and so it's basically a book about OJ that actually takes place at the Chateau Marmont and Beverly Hills, and it's a crazy kaleidoscope of this town, and we fell in love with Dominic Dunn. That's why we made him a character in the piece.
Yeah, and he's kind of imposing a bit of a showbizy, satirical view of the events, which we found very appealing.
One final student question. When you are writing about a real person, how do you decide which events and details are important to include and which ones to let go of?
A lot of it is simply what entertains us. I mean, Scott and I have been very lucky that we write scripts for an audience of two. That's sometimes that's dangerous, but you know, it's like that's why it's very hard to have someone do like some people say, "Do we do?"
Manky.
Yeah,
and an old friend of Larry's from Indiana who had a nervous breakdown and moved back to a trailer in Indiana, and we sometimes think, "Well, he'll get this joke."
Yeah,
nobody else in the world will.
Yeah, it's just what tickles us, strangely enough.
Well, it's about having an agenda.
Yeah.
If you're writing a complete piece of fiction, you're creating your ideal version of this character and how they're going to come in conflict with other characters, and all of our biopics and People versus OJ, it's our idealized versions of who we want these people to be in service of what we're trying to achieve. And there's lots of stuff about Marsha in real life and Shapiro in real life and so on that we chose to not include because it might not support our thesis. Because we have a vision of our Marsha Clark that we want to give to America. And so we include what supports that vision and we exclude what doesn't. And that's what makes us the dramatists and not just, you know, a documentary filmmaker following her around for 24 hours.
Right. But we always say also a documentary filmmaker is also making those decisions. There's, when am I shooting? What am I including? What am I cutting to? And I'm cutting to someone looking, you know, there, you know, everyone always pretends like documentaries are true and what we do is untruth. It's a messy line all throughout it all. And that's one of the things why we've never been able, we use an assistant on OJ. Assistants haven't really worked out for us in the sense that we have to do this research ourselves. People say, well, don't you have someone who does research for you? You can have someone go look up this stuff, but we're so idiosyncratic in what we dig that it's hard for someone to get in our mind in terms of like, you know, oh, that little detail that Shapiro listening to. No researcher in the right mind is going to put in there, you know, is going to circle the paragraph about Shapiro listening to Al Jarreau. For us, that was like, you better believe Al Jarreau is going to be in this thing, you know.
And then sometimes there's stuff you love that you just don't have room for.
Yeah.
Even if you have 10 hours. And here's the world's best piece of Marsha Clark trivia. And it was just, you know what I'm going to do. There's no way to include this because it's so frigging confusing. And it doesn't have anything to do with anything, but it's so interesting, which is that Marsha, and I might get this wrong because it's so confusing. Marsha Clark's first husband, not the one you see her divorce in the series, the one before that was an Israeli backgammon champion. And he got shot and paralyzed. Tell me if I get this wrong. He got shot and paralyzed by the pastor in the Church of Scientology who married Marsha to her second husband in a total coincidence. And the lawyer for the guy who shot her first husband was Bob Shapiro.
Yeah.
Did I get it right?
Yes.
Okay. Because it's so complicated.
Yeah.
And it's like, really, you're like, what?
Yeah.
And then you guys are going to walk out and you're going to like get home and turn to your roommate and go, I heard the craziest Marsha Clark thing. What? And you're not going to be able to repeat it because it's so hard to follow.
Well, it was one of those things where we were going to have, like, when she finds out Shapiro's on the case, like, her try to explain.
Oh, Shapiro.
But, like, we want to be, oh, he defended the guy who shot my first husband.
But he married me to my second husband.
It was so confusing that we just chose to ignore it. One that always bothers me, though, is the Bronco chase. Well, there's a long period where they get to Rockingham and they're sitting in the driveway. And someone calls up and gets on television and pretends to be an extra neighbor, and it's a guy from Howard Stern show. And once again, in the invention of reality television, it was Peter Jennings talking to somebody who was obviously a complete fraud, and actually the guy is actually saying Baba Booey and things like that. And having Al Michaels, who just did the Super Bowl, having get on with Peter Jennings and say, excuse me, Peter, that man just used code for a certain popular radio show, and that is not the truth. And it's this specific, but the problem was that it was so dramatic and serious and the horrible moment that was happening in the show that we couldn't go for this piece of absurdity.
We also, OJ is in this beloved movie from our childhoods called The Towering Inferno, which is just a big, stupid disaster, all-star disaster movie. I think I got nominated for Best Picture. But it's
Irwin Allen, right?
Irwin Allen. It's just a big, big, dumb piece of entertainment. It's like Twister. Or, I don't know. It's just a silly movie. OJ is in it as a fireman. And there's a scene where he saves Fred Astaire's cat. And we were just dying to recreate this moment. And we were, but the movie was shot in the early 70s. And so we were just like trying to figure out how he could just like wedge in like a Fred Astaire lookalike with Cuba and the little cat. And it has nothing to do with anything. It's just, it made us happy to talk about this. Like I can dream. I can dream that we can recreate the Towering Inferno. This is the stuff that makes us happy.
O.J. Simpson Made in America came out same year that the People vs. O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, it's kind of suspicious.
Did you watch it?
Yeah.
Yes.
And what did you get out of the experience of watching it?
Well, it's really funny because I think Ezra was really afraid of our show. And we were, I wouldn't say we were afraid of his show, but it was just was kind of weird that, you know, that these two huge pieces about OJ were coming out at the exact same time. One of my favorite reviews, I think it was the New York Times, that said, if you had told me a year ago that I would watch two 10-hour shows about O.J. Simpson, and it still wasn't enough, and I still wanted more, you know, that I would have thought you were completely crazy. But I thought, what I got out of it particularly was Ezra's first episode and last episode, which is covers the stuff that's not in the before and after of our show, which, first of all, I think his thing is quite excellent. But most of the other stuff that takes place during our time period, Scott and I were very familiar with those clips, so it wasn't like we were getting new information. But it was great to have that section about OJ's football career and what he meant at SC and what he meant to the world. And that was sort of what Scott was getting at earlier, talking about, you know, we really wanted people to understand who OJ Simpson was.
Could have talked Ezra into including the Fred Astaire cat.
There you go. Scene.
And then we have this full, to your research question, we have a strong practical sense philosophy, which is you don't do any research that follows the period of time that you intend to cover, because you only have so many, you have more brain cells because you're younger than me, but you only have so many brain cells. And so our knowledge of OJ stops in 95. It's just like, we know everything leading up to the trial. We know the trial. And after that, I don't care, because my brain was so full of OJ trivia. And so for me, the episode 5 of Ezra's thing for me was mind blowing, which was the Florida episode.
Yeah.
Because I knew nothing about OJ in Florida. And that was just crazy. So, yeah, I really enjoyed that one.
Okay. Best piece of advice, career advice, work advice, writer advice you ever got?
You
got
to write something that you love.
Right.
You got to, if it's a movie or a TV show, it's got to be a show that you would really want to see.
Right. That, I think, is a gigantic piece of advice. I'll take it back to when Ed Wood was coming out. And I think we got Entertainment Weekly, and it had the review. And I remember Scott and I was running up to our office, and we were reading the review. And I turned to Scott and I said, like, if we hadn't written this movie, I would be so excited right now to see this movie. You know what I mean? That I would be the first guy in line to go see this. And so I would say that to you guys, in a sense, write something you want to see, not something you think somebody else wants to see, or not something that you think the marketplace wants. Because hopefully that if it's something you want to see, there's a sincerity to it and there's a reason for it. And hopefully that will connect with other people as well. You're not some stranger, in your own world. So it's allowed us to write very idiosyncratic things, but you know, because we're having such a kick out of doing it, I think that our joy of writing that stuff transfers over to the screen.
I mean, also, you guys are growing up in this era where it's affordable to make your own feature. I mean, I mentor one or two SC students a year. And I'm sort of shocked when they can come out of school with a script and I give them notes on it. And then they scrape together $40,000, $50,000 and they buy the Sony digital camera for $5,000. And they shoot a movie that looks like a real movie. And it has the same resolution and the same picture quality as a movie I'd go pay $15 to see at the Arclight, which is crazy to me. So, and then they can go, whatever. And then you go home and you cut it on your Mac. And this is all stuff that was not available to us, because we're old. And so if you have this ability to go make your own movies, only do it when you have a script that you are just so fucking excited about. And you're like, oh my God, this is going to be the greatest movie of all time. Because once you commit to doing this stuff, it is years out of your life. You know, and it's just like, oh, some little coming of age thing about a kid who learns to speak up for himself. And it's sort of like, oh God, you know, it's like you want that movie that you spend like all summer waiting for, like, oh my God, this is my movie. And it doesn't even mean it has to be elaborate. You know, it's like, you know, two movies up for Best Picture right now, you know, Lady Bird and Get Out. Either of those movies could have been shot for $50,000 on that Sony camera. It wasn't about, oh, it takes place in a house and there's a car. It's like, there's nothing else in Get Out. But it's great storytelling with a small cast, but it was clearly a movie that, like, Jordan Peele's like, oh my God, this movie's going to be so cool and it's going to say so much. And so it's not really about resources at a certain point. It's just about, you know, a great story that you think you can make a kick-ass movie with.
Ladies and gentlemen, join me in thanking Scott and Larry.
Thank you guys. It was great.
With that, we bring to a close this episode of Jury Duty, The Legacy of the OJ Trial. Please join us on our next installment as we present part one of Carrie's interview with Ezra Edelman, producer and director of the Oscar and Emmy-winning 10-hour documentary OJ, Made in America. And if you would like to listen to these episodes early and ad-free, head over to our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page. You can find more information about this trial on our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page or at crimestory.com. Jury Duty is created and produced by Carrie and Tholis. It was co-produced by yours truly, Chris Terracone, and edited by Tristan Friedberg Rodman. Music for this episode was provided by Strike Audio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next episode of Jury Duty.